international loan documentation. We want to consider the structure and content of a typical international lending facility agreement that we would use in international finance. This will typically be used as part of the Eurodollar market, whereby we are drawing down in a currency other than the currency of issuance, although we will also use almost identical provisions in domestic lending or in home currency lending. So sterling borrowed in London would be a domestic rather than a Eurodollar deal. Whether it's a foreign currency deal, a Eurodollar deal, or a domestic deal, all of the same core provisions apply. So if we work through this, we can understand the basic structure and content of any typical type of lending facility document that we would use in any specific markets, as well as related parallel markets, such as acquisition finance, property finance, project finance, and other areas. As always, there's three core sets of provisions. We have the financials, we have the obligations, and we have the defaults. So we will see here, we've got two facilities. We've got a facility A and a facility B. Facility A is the term loan. That's for a fixed duration. You draw down, borrow for up to 10 years, possibly 20 years. You repay principal. You do not borrow again. You cannot draw it down again, and the specific clauses to that effect. That's for the larger fixed amount. What we will also do is have a supporting revolving facility that we can usually use, for example, for working capital purposes. It tends to be smaller. There'll be shorter rollovers so that we can draw down, repay, and then draw down again. It might be 3-month rollovers, it might be 1-month rollovers. But what we will see is this. We have a term A and a term B, which is for a fixed duration and a revolving rollover. We will then have the... So that's the amount which will be specified and the duration. We will have the interest, which is provided for in clause 9. It used to always be LIBOR, the London Interbank Offered Rate. We're now moving to a series of separate, what we call risk-free rates in different financial centres. So it's SONIA in London, which is the sterling overnight interest average. SOFR, secured overnight funding rate in New York. SHIBOR in Shanghai, MIBOR in Mumbai, TIBOR in Tokyo, EURIBOR in Europe, although you also have the option of using ESTR provided by the European Central Bank, or EONIA produced by the European Banking Federation. What we then see is we've got drawdown is provided for under Article 4. Drawdown specifically is triggered in practice using what we call a utilisation request. That's a drawdown instruction. We will draw down during an availability period, which is separately specified in the documentation. We have our interest, and then we have repayment and prepayment is provided for under 7 and 8. These are all of the core financial provisions. What we then do is this. We support those with the conditions precedent, with the representations and warranties, and then with the defaults. We will see the CPs are incorporated from Schedule 2, and I've summarised all of the key CPs on the left panel, top right. Constitutional documents, board resolutions, specimen signatures, guarantor resolutions. The way we manage this in practice, it's a clever little legal device. What we're going to do is this. We're going to specify that the borrowers can draw down by serving a utilisation request on the agent bank. However, the condition for that's in Article 5.1, all of the CPs must have been delivered and there must be no outstanding defaults. That's in 4.1 and 4.2, including any subsequent conditions precedent, with these being effectively repeated every time those are drawn down. That's the device for incorporating the CPs from Schedule 2. We then have the representations in 19, effectively the legal representations. We've got the financial representations and warranties in 20, and then we have the financial covenants in 21 and the corporate covenants in 22. And all of the typical core provisions that we would expect are incorporated here. On the corporate covenants, negative pledge, disposals, merger, I've listed some of the core financial covenants we would expect in practice. Minimum net worth, the MNW, EBITDA is earnings before tax, depreciation and amortization. Consolidated net debt, dividend payment restrictions, cash retention and the leverage ratio. The LMA does not include those specific provisions in its model. Those are provided by the accountants acting on behalf of the banks. The law firms will have their own standard models for all of this, and they will have key clauses that they always use in practice. I've provided some other sample clauses on the system so you can see how these work. Just in terms of the other core provisions on the representations, so we have status, binding obligations, no conflict, power and authority, validity, governing law, deduction of tax, no filing, and then key provisions. No default, 19.9. No misleading information, that's misrepresentation, 19.10. Financial statements are up to date and accurate, pari passu, 12. No proceedings pending or threatened. That's a very important clause. Virtually all large international companies, including governments, will always be subject to some form of litigation, almost always. So what we need to do is we need to check the precise terms of these clauses and become familiar with them. There's a number of standard provisions that we would expect to be in those clauses. We need to look at them and see that they're fairly drafted in appropriate terms for our particular deal. If we're acting for the banks, we may want it a bit more bank preferred. If we're acting for the borrower, we may want to slightly tighten it up a bit more. But we want to ensure that we get something that's just fair and operable and workable in practice, and we'll come back and look at the actual specific drafting for each of those. But these are the types of key provisions that we're going to look at. We will then see again, we'll get repetition in 1914. So remember that we're effectively repeating all of the CPs every time we serve a utilization request under 5.1, and then we're going to repeat all of the representations again under 19.14. There's overlap in certain provisions. So you'll see, again, for example, binding obligations, and then financial statements comes up in 1911, information reps in 20, and then the financial covs in 21, and then breach will be tied to that in the default provisions as well. Look for these overlaps, look for these connections, look for these relationships. What we're trying to do is we're trying to tie the obligations, the CPs, the reps and Ws, and the covs to ensuring that the agreed facilities are made available, but if anything goes wrong, we will then incorporate those into the default clauses. The defaults in this document are set out in 23. So obvious key sets of defaults: non-payment, breach of financial covenants, breach of other obligations, misrepresentation, very important again. And remember, that goes back to no misleading information in 1910. I will then give you separate materials on the law of misrepresentation. We're looking at innocent, negligent and fraudulent misrepresentation. We have statutory misrepresentation with deceit under the Theft Act, and we also have statutory misrepresentation under the Misrepresentation Act 1967. I've provided separate material on this. Look for these overlaps, look for these provisions coming up in separate clauses so that you can tie these together, ensure that they work effectively off each other. That's one of the key, most important functions when you're drafting and revising documentation. You need to make sure that all the different clauses tie off each other, work with each other, do not contradict each other, go back to the core definitions and ensure that everything works to protect the interests of your particular client. In other types of law, it may be that if you get an advantage for some reason, you may want to protect that and not disclose it. In the finance area, you will disclose it. The whole point is we want these facilities to work. We need these transactions to go through. Everybody's rights and obligations are protected by ensuring that all of this works effectively in practice. So if we see errors, we will change them, we will correct them, because we want to make sure that all of this does operate effectively in practice and respects the interests of all of the parties and the underlying objectives of all of the counterparties concerned. We will see misrepresentation, so cross default. We need to always check the cross default clause. You then get a series of preceding clauses, so standard provisions on insolvency, other insolvency proceedings, other creditor processes. Loss of ownership, and again, that will tie in with other protective clauses. We're going to look for that. For example, disposals in 22.4, so we can connect those two together. Repudiation, unlawfulness, we'll see again, ties back to prepayment provisions earlier on, and then the material adverse change. The MAC clause, again, isn't provided by the LMA, although I've given you other sample MAC clauses. The problem simply is this. The banks are going to want a very general, generous MAC that's triggered in almost any areas, situations. If you do that, however, it gives you too much protection, and it can also easily trigger the cross default. You have to be careful with that. The borrowers, on the other hand, will want something much more tight, much narrower, much more restrictive. And again, we'll look at draft clauses to see how this works in practice. In terms of the remedies then, as far as I'm concerned, there's actually five remedies. You can suspend drawdown. You can cancel future drawdown. You can accelerate, then cancel out everything outright. You can then accelerate, you can rescind, and you can sue for damages. In practice, we're never going to need to rescind as such, because we can always get our remedies under the documentation. Anyway, the whole point is that we want to put the banks, if we're acting for the banks, in the strongest position. If something goes wrong, we still need to assist the borrower. The banks want principal repaid, they want interest during term, so we will renegotiate. But what we're trying to do is ensure that the banks can always renegotiate from a position of strength. So that's why we're trying to ensure that their interests are properly respected and that they have that ability to do so. We're very rarely going to need to rescind unless we're looking at full insolvency, and then we'll go to full damages. But in practice, we will simply reschedule. And if necessary, very often, we'll extend term, we can reduce interest. If absolutely necessary, we can write off. What tends to happen is, if it's sovereign lending, government to government, or international financial institutions, they will rarely want to surrender or cancel principal, but they will extend term and reduce the interest rates. For private lending, very often you can get a deduction on the principal amount as well. And then everything else is then built around those three core sets of provisions: the financials, the obligations, and the defaults. So let's just look at how the rest of this comes together in practice. All of the parties are initially defined. So we're going to have the borrower is the original obligor. We're going to see it's defined as the company. And you just need to watch that. As you're working through, some clauses will refer to the company, some to the obligors, some to different terms. You just need to watch this. So we have these collective terms and then these other more specific terms. You need to be very familiar with this. Every word counts. You need to see how this all builds up to ensure that all of the parties are subject to the obligations that were intended, and the overall effect of all of the contractual provisions is to ensure that everyone is aware and everyone secures their original objectives. So we've got the borrower, we've got the obligors, we've got the finance parties, we're going to have guarantors and new guarantors and replacement guarantors. We have the reference banks, we have security, we have subsidiary. We're going to have an agent bank is going to administer the loan once everything's been entered into and we start to draw down. The arranger is the lead bank who's going to set the facility up. And then we have the lenders. So we look at all these key terms to make sure all of this works in practice. We will go through the interpretation clause in 1.1 very carefully to ensure that we're satisfied with everything. I've just mentioned some of the key core provisions on the right, the availability period. You will specify a term during which the A is available and the B is available. The A typically might be 2 years. You can draw down for up to 2 years. After that 2 years, you cannot draw down more. With the revolver, it might be 2 years, it might be five, for example, in a 20-year facility. It could be restricted, or it might be left open for the whole of the duration. We will tie that in, we will see, to what we call the, in 22.1, the commitment fee. The borrowers will actually have to pay a fee for the whole facility to be made available, whether they draw down or don't draw down. So you will always pay a commitment fee at the bottom there, 12.1, which covers everything, whether you draw down or not. If you do want to draw down, you have to watch your timing to make sure you draw down within the availability specified for either the A or for the B. With the available commitment is the proportion that each bank will provide. The banks will be listed in Schedule 1, as a matter of practice, what you'll see is, I think this is principally for tax reasons, you will have, or maybe regulatory reasons, you will have the lenders, other than UK non-bank lenders, and then a separate schedule for UK non-bank lenders, basically building societies, finance companies, other types of facilities. The lenders will be listed, and then the amount that they're providing will also be stated there. That specifies their proportion. The proportions do not have to be equal. So for example, if this was a 100 million loan facility, if we have one company and nine subsidiaries, we've got 10 borrowers or 10 obligors in the language of the text, we will then have possibly 10 lending banks. They do not have to lend 10 million each. They can lend in any proportion that they wish. That will be specified in Schedule 1. They are only liable up to their proportional commitment. And as we work through the clauses, we will see how, so for example, the liability is several, and that's provided for in 2.2a. Obligations are several, which means that if one of the banks doesn't make available its share, the other banks are not liable to do so. If that occurs, one of the banks needs to withdraw. Before the facility comes into effect, the arranging bank will bring in another bank. If it's after the loan agreement's been signed and we've had drawdown, has already commenced, the agent bank will try and replace. But the banks themselves do not have to cover for each other because the obligations are several. There's other key definitions we'll always check. The base currency, the break cost, interest period. There's then an interesting relationship. You've got definitions in 1.1, and then you've got separate construction provisions in 1.2. It's quite difficult sometimes to work out the difference. What tends to happen is specific terms are defined, and then you've got the use and application is set out in the construction clauses. So it sort of extends the provision again. You just need to check and make sure that you see how the relationship, all of this works together. So for example, on construction, we actually have clauses such as indebtedness. So clearly indebtedness is going to come up for the negative pledge clause and for security references. So you need to be able to check your definition of security and indebtedness, and then the provisions in the negative pledge or other disclosure clauses. So you need to be able to work out how all of these provisions fit together and how all of this comes together in practice as a live, living, dynamic document and a live, dynamic transaction. Just on break costs, we mentioned break cost arises when you have a prepayment. Banks do not like prepayment because what that means is the principal is repaid early, which means they do not get interest for the rest of the facility. You already know that the borrower will have paid a commitment fee anyway, calculated against the total amount made available, so it will have to pay the commitment fee. If it does prepay, what the break clause provides for, and again, you build in your references, your cross-references, we'll actually see this provided for in Article Section 8.7b, and then again in 11.4. And this is what you will do. You go through your document, you get your outline and your document, and you start making all the cross-references. The break costs are provided for, the obligation to pay is Section 8.7b, and then this has to be paid within 3 business days in Section 11.4. The break costs provide that if there's prepayment during an interest period, the borrower has to pay the difference between what the bank can obtain by putting the funds back into the interbank markets and what it should have received, which is in the margin. And the margin is provided for, we'll see in 9.1a. So if the banks are expecting a 250 basis point margin, that's 2.5%, that will be over the risk-free rate, in this case, the SONIA rate. If you prepay, what the borrower has to pay is a break cost. The break cost is the difference between the SONIA rate and what the bank expected, which is the margin. You don't have to pay all of it because the banks can put the money back in the market. Either they will have drawn down because it's a repayment, so there's already been a withdrawal of the funds. Because of a prepayment, they can put the funds back into the markets, so therefore the break cost is the difference between what the banks earn by putting the funds back into the markets and what they should have received for the residual period. That's the break costs. There's a standard clause which denies third-party rights so that third parties do not have rights under this documentation. That's the standard practice in finance and other contractual clauses. So we have the facilities. We're going to specify the A and the B, and then very important clauses 2.2. This establishes the relationship between the banks and the borrowers and the banks inter se. So we're going to see that the parties' rights and obligations are several. They're not joint and several, they're several, as well as rights are separate and independent so that the banks can enforce them separately, and then we can have separate enforcement and execution in A, B and C. So all of this reinforces each other. Now, an interesting point here is this. In the definition section, a loan is defined as a facility A loan and a facility B loan. But what we will see is this. The rights are separate and independent under 2.2b, as well as the obligations are separate and independent under 2.2b. To go back to our example, if we have a 100 million facility, we have 10 banks, we have an A and a B. If the borrower draws down, let's say with a 2-year availability period, and you can draw down once a month for 2 years, what that means is this. You're then going to have 10 borrowers drawing down once a month for up to 2 years. So what's that? That's 10 times 2 times 12 is 240, right? If the B facility is open for the full 20 years, that's going to be 10 times 12 times 20 is 2,400. Now, that's if a loan, and this is what the clause, the definitions provide. A loan, capital L, is a facility A loan and a facility B loan. So there's going to be a minimum of 240 plus 2,400 is 2,640. That's the minimum capital L loans. However, if we then read that also with section 2.2b in brackets, which specifies that the rights and the obligations are separate and independent, if each of the borrower's obligations to each of the banks is separate and independent, and there's 10 banks, all of that's times 10. So strictly speaking, there are 2,400 loans. If we have 240 plus 2,400, that makes 2,640 capital L loans. But if we consider the total number of loan obligations under this documentation, it's actually that times 12. So it's not 2,400, it's 24,000. And if we add 2,400 and 24,000, we get 26,400. So it's quite a small fine point of law, but just note that. Loan, capital L, is a loan A and a loan B. Strictly speaking, that will include all of the banks in each one. However, if we then read that with 2.2b, which specifies that the obligations are also separate and independent, we've got capital L, 2,640 capital L loans. But if we consider the total number of loans, the total number of drawdowns, the total number of repayment obligations is actually 26,400. In normal standard euro currency deals, we do not specify a purpose. If this is to be used in connection with another more specific type of facility, such as a project finance deal, we will specify the purpose. If it's a project finance deal, the purpose is only to support the construction, development, and management and operation of the particular facility. In some cases, we will specify a purpose. Generally, we don't. Standard euro currency loans, this will be left blank. Even if we do have a purpose, there's no obligation on the parties to monitor. That's in 3.2. Drawdown is then specified for in 4. We are going to allow drawdown through the service of a utilization request, which is provided for in Schedule 3. However, the condition is that All the CPs must have been delivered and there's no outstanding event of default. The conditions precedent are then effectively incorporated through the drawdown, and we will look at the content of a utilization request. It's irrevocable. It has to specify the amount, the facility A or B, and the interest currency, and various other core key provisions. We may have additional further conditions precedent provided for in 4.2. We have conditions, so that because it's a multi-currency, we can swap currencies. There will always be a base currency, although we can also exchange that for other currencies, and there's provision for that. Optional currencies are then provided for in section 6. Repayment is in 7, prepayment is in 8. The key thing is that if we're going to prepay, we're then subject to the break cost at the top. Interest, this is important because what we can determine is the total payment obligations of the borrower under the facility. Under section 9.1, the borrower is going to pay. The margin is the bank's profit. That will be expressed as a percentage or BPS. So 250 BPS is 2.5%. The banks always want a 2.5% profit. What's it going to cost the bank to enter into this facility? It's borrowing costs on the interbank market, so it's going to draw down on SONIA. So the borrowers will pay margin plus the risk-free rate. The interbank rate is, in our case, SONIA. Plus, they also pay what's called a mandatory cost formula. Now, the mandatory cost used to have a standard clause in the LMA, although they've removed it simply because there's become too many regulators involved. The mandatory cost is essentially a regulatory charge. The regulators in the UK, it'll be the Bank of England, and then the Financial Conduct Authority, they make a very small charge for dealing in these large markets, which effectively pay for their operating costs. It's a very, very small amount. So, for example, the Bank of England will typically charge up to 0.4% over any deal over it's the total eligible liabilities of the bank over 500 million. So it's 0.4% over 500 million. It's a very, very small amount, but it has to be paid. Because the bank's lending, that adds to its total amount of eligible liabilities, it therefore has to pay a small amount to the Bank of England, therefore the borrower has to pay this. So if the bank's going to have to pay 0.4% on this loan, and for example, it's 10 million, it's part of the 100 million facility, so 0.4% will be charged by the Bank of England to the bank, therefore the borrower has to pay that. But what also happens is, and this was partly why they removed the clause, the standard clause they had before, the FCA will now also ask for a small payment than any other regulators involved, such as, for example, the ECB. Because it's become a lot more complex in practice, it depends upon the local financial centre. LMA's just left this clause blank. I'll give you links on the system to how this is dealt with in practice. So the borrower is principally going to pay the margin, the interbank rate, and the mandatory cost. But what we'll also see is this. What else? And I've highlighted these in red. The borrowers will pay under 9.1. We will then link that to the fees. So the commitment fee is the amount they have to pay. This is defined in defined terms, so you can go back to the definition section in 1.1. The commitment fee is a charge on the total amount that's made available. Quite small. Because the key payment that the banks receive is the interest following drawdown. But you still pay a commitment fee on the total amount made available. The arrangement fee is what the investment bank, the lead bank, will receive for setting the facility up. Typically, 0.75%. That would be a standard clause. So 0.75% of 100 million. The arranging bank will put this together, possibly within a 4-week period, and then move on to the next deal, the next deal, the next deal. In practice, the arranging banks very often, they want the very high arrangement fee. They're not that interested in the actual interest charges, the lending fee in 9.1b. They're not really interested in the margin, 9.1a, plus the interbank, 9.1b.
So they will bring in another bank behind them. We call that a participation. And if it's a blind participation, the arranging bank will sell on its obligation to lend. It will transfer its obligation to lend, bring another bank in behind it. If the borrower doesn't know, we call it a blind participation or a sub-participation. We actually have transfer instruments provided for. You will see in Schedules 5 and 6. The old LME had a novation in Schedule 5. It's now included under the more recent versions, an assignment in Schedule 6. The difference between a novation and an assignment is you can only assign benefits. So if you're transferring obligations, you have to novate. With a novation, you cancel the first obligation and you substitute, you replace it with a new set of obligations which are adhered to, undertaken by the replacement party coming in. So the arrangement fee is quite large. The agency fee will be very small. It's an administrative fee that's paid to the agent bank, and we will see when we look at the core clauses which specify the duties of the agent bank in 26 that these are purely of an administrative and non-executive nature. Therefore, the agency fee will be quite small. The agent bank actually runs the facility, but because a lot of it is more of a mechanical nature, it's a small fee that it will receive. So the borrower is going to pay 9.1 margin, risk-free rate and mandatory costs, as well as all of the fees in 12. It's also going to pay any gross-up provisions in 13.2, tax indemnity provisions in 3 and tax credits in 4. And we're also going to see, just jumping on, moving on, increased costs in 14.1, currency information 15.1, other indemnities 15.2, agent indemnity 15.3, transaction expenses in 17.1, amendment costs in 17.2, enforcement costs in 17.3, as well as it may be liable as a guarantor or as an indemnifier under 18.1 for both the guarantees and the indemnity. There's approximately 18 separate charges there. And all you simply do is you draw lines from 9.1 to all of these other charges. There's about 18 separate expenses, costs the borrowers will have to pay. Just to highlight some of these again, the tax gross-up clause 13.2. Because this is large professional international transactions, we generally do not have a withholding tax, and we try to design these so that there's no withholding tax. If there is a withholding tax, very often we simply move the facility to another jurisdiction where there's no withholding tax. The withholding tax means that the banks aren't subject to any pre-tax on the interest payments. If, for example, you have 100,000-something or 100,000,000-something, and there's a 10% withholding tax, you gross up. Now, how do you gross up 100 of something to with a 10% withholding? Does that go to 110? No, it doesn't, because if you got to 110, 10% of 110 is 11, take away 100 is 89, so the banks don't receive everything they expected. If you're going to gross up 100 with a 10% withholding tax, you need to gross up to 111. So 111, 10% of 111 is 11. Take 111, 11 off 111, you get 100. So the banks get what they expected. With a gross up, you need to gross up to a larger amount so that when you deduct that paid by the borrower, the banks receive the original net figure that was intended. In practice, very often, governments support these transactions so they will not impose withholding taxes, or we can simply move the jurisdiction if necessary. If there is a charge which arises, borrowers have to pay. Just on guarantee and indemnity, what's the difference? A guarantee is a secondary obligation conditional on non-payment of a primary obligation. That's a guarantee. So if the borrower doesn't pay, somebody else has to pay. And what will happen is, in practice, each of the companies will guarantee each other. Because that is, strictly speaking, contrary to company law, the directors of one company have to act in the interest of the company that they're the directors of. They're not acting in the interest of other companies. So, strictly speaking, it's actually contrary to the best interest of one company to act as a guarantor for another company unless it's got a separate commercial benefit from this. The separate commercial benefit in practice is the fact that if each of the companies are party to these facilities, they can draw down a much larger amount at a much finer rate than would otherwise be available. That's the commercial advantage. for that reason, they participate in this, the condition being they have to guarantee these other companies. If they don't guarantee the other companies, they cannot benefit from the larger facility that they are a party to. And what we will do is we'll have a resolution to that effect signed by each of the companies, confirming that they think it's in the best interest of each company to participate in this larger facility, including providing the guarantees and indemnities to the other banks involved. And that will then be included within the conditions precedent. What's the difference between the guarantee and the indemnity? An indemnity is an open obligation to cover any loss. It's not conditional on non-repayment of the other obligation. So a guarantee is a primary and secondary obligation, a conditional obligation. An indemnity is just an open obligation to cover any loss. Slight variation. An indemnity is more general than a guarantee. We've already mentioned the representations and warranties. So we've got the legal reps and W's in 19. We've got the financial reps and W's in 20. The covenants, normally you would consider the corporate covs first, that's in 22, and then we add the financial covs in 21. There's no standard drafting, as I've mentioned, so I'll provide sample clauses on the system separately. We then tie all of these obligations into the events of default. The other standard provisions that we would expect to see in these large documents is change of lenders. We're going to bring in other lenders as primary lenders want to step down. So we have transfer arrangements provided for. You'll see under Schedules A and B, transfer certificates. We can either novate or we can assign. If you want to transfer the obligations, it has to be a novation. We can also change obligors. So we have a resignation letter. We have an accession letter provided for, again, in the schedules. You'll see Schedules 7 and 8, so we can draw lines across. Key provision is 26. Because this specifies the duties of the arranging bank and of the agent bank. What we'll see is this. Each of the banks is going to separately appoint the agent bank to act on its interest under the facility. So again, we had multiple loans, we effectively have multiple appointments. So each of the banks separately appointing the agent bank to act in its interest, as are the borrowers. So appointment of the agent bank is in 26.1. We will see the duties of the agent are specified in section 26.2. These are partly positive, they're partly negative. We'll go over that. It's principally to do with notification of default duties and then carrying out their banking duties separately. The role of the arranger is specified in 26.3. And then, as we would expect, the clause specifies there are no obligations of any kind. The arranging bank, the lead bank who sets this up, has no obligations, because if it has any obligations and something goes wrong, it can get sued. So it simply specifies, this is called a no duty clause. It simply says, I have no duties under this documentation, therefore if anything goes wrong, you cannot sue me. It's a no duty clause, it's an exclusion clause. A form of exclusion, and I deal with this separately in the liability chapter I will give you. So 26.3 specifies that the role of the arranger is that it has no obligations whatsoever of any form under this document. What we also then do, and this is standard practice, we specify that neither the arranging bank nor the agent bank has any fiduciary duty under this document. 26.4, the agent bank can, however, conduct business. 26.5, rights and discretions, it's allowed to act on assumptions and appoint agents and take instructions. Majority lenders, there's limited majority function, majority delegation. If there is, we've already defined majority back in section 1.1. It's not a simple 50% majority, but it's 66 2/3. So it's a qualified majority. We specify the provisions in which we can have some form of majority voting are listed there, but it's very narrow because the banks want to act in their own interest and take decisions to protect their own best positions going forward. Again, a key clause, you always check this one, 26.9, exclusion of liability. You need to see what the drafting is. The agent bank and the arranging bank want to ensure that they're not liable for any possible loss which could arise unless they have done something beyond a certain standard. You'll see the common language used here is gross negligence or willful misconduct. So there has to be not just negligence, but gross negligence or a deliberate intent. So it's intentional misconduct. It's not misconduct, it's intentional misconduct. So that's a very high bar. So basically, you cannot sue the agent bank or the arranging bank unless you get above a very, very high bar. That's a standard, typical exclusion clause. There's then other standard provisions on indemnity for the lender, so we could take that. That's the lender's indemnity to the agent. That's not the borrower's indemnity to the agent. We saw the borrower's liability under 9.1. This is the lender's liability to the agent. Confidentiality obligation 26.12. There is a standard confidentiality provision which was available under Schedule 11. It's been deleted, and the law firm will insert its own standard clause, standard set of provisions in practice. We then have a number of other more administrative clauses. So, conduct of business by the finance parties. The parties can generally continue to conduct their business. Sharing amongst finance parties. This is pari passu. The finance parties have to share. If they receive a benefit that somebody else didn't receive, they have to pay it to the agent bank. The agent bank divides that in terms of the proportions of each institution and pays it back out. There is an exception at the end. The banks can take action, independent, separate action. Why? Because that's already provided for in 2.2b, separate rights, so they can enforce separately, and then separate enforcement and execution is referred to expressly in 2.2c. Because of that, we tie that in with 28.5, the exceptions there. If the banks notify each other they're going to take action, if they invite the other banks come in but they decline not to do and do not take any separate action, if the bank then recovers in those circumstances, it can keep the benefit. Contrary to the pari passu clause that would otherwise apply. We then have payment mechanics 29. We have set off in 30. What you'll see is this. We deny set off by the borrowers against the banks, but the banks are full set off against the borrowers. So you'll see that 29.6 and 30. We have notice clauses, calculation clauses. There's no invalidity. There's no remedies and waivers. They're all protected so that one small piece of action does not negate the rest of the document. That's the same with what we call an illegality invalidity clause. Even if something becomes unenforceable or invalid, it doesn't invalidate the rest of the transaction. So standard language we would expect. Amendment and waiver clauses, standard provisions, counterparts. You can have any number of counterparts, are original that you specify and sign separately. And then, very important, a governing law and enforcement clause. We need to specify the governing law. You can leave it to be assigned in practice under the relevant international treaties or conventions or European regulations. You have the Lugano Convention, you have the Rome European provisions. You can rely on these. In practice, we're going to specify. We're going to pick the law that we want to govern this, which we think is going to respect and protect the party's interest. In practice, most documents will be governed by English law or New York law. It's increasingly common that if, for example, a large lender in a particular country is making available all of the facilities, for example, Saudi Arabia or Dubai, it is increasingly common to use local laws in that situation. Typically, however, it will be English law or New York law. But also separately, you need to specify the jurisdiction which can hear the case. So usually it will be the same, but it doesn't have to be. So, for example, you could have English governing law and then, well, you could have New York governing law and then select English law for the courts. In that case, the English judges, the commercial court in London, in the High Court, has to apply New York law as the relevant law. And it can do. That's very common. That happens very in practice. We see that a lot. You will try and keep them the same if you can, unless there's any other reason for that. But again, what you're trying to do is this. You're trying to ensure that you have a country, you have a judicial system that you trust, that will respect your interests and have an open, independent judgment. And then also separately, that you can enforce that judgment. You need to ensure that you can both get the judgment and then that you can enforce that in practice. So very important pair of provisions. I've summarised the core elements there. Exclusive most appropriate, concurrent. This basically just reflects case law. There will be a whole series of decisions and case law which interpret and apply specific applications of this, this, and this, and this. What the lawyers who've drafted these clauses are doing is they're looking at this case law and they're coming up with something which is most effective in practice to ensure it protects the intention of the parties to the maximum possible extent. And then you have the schedules. You have the original parties, you have conditions precedent, you have the request, that's the utilisation, mandatory cost formula you'll insert in 4, transfer, novation in 5, assignments now in 6, then accession and resignation letters, any separate compliance certificates, that's one of the CPs you'll provide for in 9 in a standard format, any existing security you're disclosing so you don't breach the negative pledge, you'll provide for in 10, confidentiality you insert now in 11, the LMA leaves that blank, it's for the law firm to insert an appropriate clause, and then you have some timetable provisions at the end, and that's basically this document. And what we can do is this, although it's 100 pages, we can understand how the whole thing comes together, how all the core provisions work with each other, and we can develop a very strong understanding of how all of this applies in practice. This is the key standard documentation used in the international Euroloan and syndicated lending market, but also all of these key provisions will then be replicated in almost all other different types of facility arrangement, facility structure, as well as we can see parallel sets of provisions, although with some revision, used in the capital markets and in the derivatives markets.